a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad to be with you on the program today. Yes, it was 20 years ago today. No, Sergeant Pepper didn't teach the band to play. Bearing Arms, well, Cam and Company, NRA News Cam and Company at the time, made its debut at the 2004 NRA annual meetings in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And here we are, two decades later. I'm still just as, you know, baby-faced as I was 20... No, I'm not. No, it is like George Washington at the end of the American Revolution when he said, I've grown not only gray but blind in service to this country. I have grown a little bushier over the past 20 years. Yeah, a little more blind as well, now that I think about it. But I cannot tell you how thankful I am to be able to continue to do Cam and Company most each and every weekday here at BearingArms.com. It has been an amazing 20 years. You know, when we first started Cam and Company in 2004, it was a pre-Heller world, right? Not just pre-Bruin, pre-Heller. We were still fighting for that basic recognition that the right to keep and bear arms was and is a right of individual Americans. And we have come a long way since 2004. We have seen the adoption. I mean, in 2004, we were still fighting to get shall issue concealed carry in states like Ohio and Illinois and Wisconsin. The writing was on the wall for the may issue regimes in those states, but it was still a fight. And now we're in a position where every state in the union is theoretically, anyway, a shall issue state. More than half of the country is constitutional carry. We've made incredible advances over the past 20 years, and I'm excited to see where the journey takes us over the next two decades in terms of, again, defending and strengthening our right to keep and bear arms. I want to thank everybody who sent me an email or reached out on social media to say happy anniversary and congratulations. I can't tell you how much that means to me. You know, a huge part of Cam and Company has always been the community, right? And so for those of you who have been listening and watching for years, thank you for your continued support. And I hope that we get a chance to do this again for many years to come. Now, we're not going to be looking back. I said that on yesterday's show. I'm a big believer in looking forward. So we are going to be talking in just a moment with Pete Fricelli, retired ATF assistant director. I wanted to get Pete's thoughts on the new engaged in the business rule, because one of the things that Pete did when he was at ATF was to, you know, go after people who were selling guns when they should have had a federal firearms license. Now the agency is broadly expanding who is engaged in the business, despite the fact that 40 years ago, there were complaints that there were too many FFLs, the ATF and the Biden administration now essentially demanding that almost every gun owner who might sell a firearm from their personal collection get a federal firearms license if they're selling that firearm for profit of any kind, maybe as little as a penny, right? So there are some issues here, not just from the pro-Second Amendment perspective. But even if you are a gun control advocate, there are reasons why you should be concerned about the ATF's expansive new rule, as we'll get into with Pete Fricelli. Take a look and a listen. Pete, thanks so much for coming back on the show. It's good to see you again.
Honored to be here. Thanks for having me, Cam.
You bet. Well, listen, I mean, when we had the official word about the engaged in the business rule being formalized, finalized, published in the Federal Register, set to go into effect here in just a couple of months, I wanted to give you some time to digest that final rule, because it is it's lengthy. But I wanted to get your take on this, because this was something that was in your purview when you were working at ATF, right? You at times were investigating people who should have, who were engaged in the business, right? They were selling firearms, not just out of their personal collection, but they should have had an FFL. So you've worked these types of cases before.
Yeah, many of them, and, you know, especially when I worked in Phoenix, where we had people who were funneling guns down to the cartels. So, I mean, we worked these cases. We had the laws at our disposal, as we discussed in one of my previous visits on your show, but they weren't prosecuted. So it kind of blows my mind that ATF has decided to go down this path. First off, Congress has already defined in the law what they believed engaged in the business to be. So how ATF now has decided, well, we don't necessarily like that law, so we're going to redefine it and push forth this ruling, is troublesome to me. And look, I'll be honest with you, it's troublesome to a lot of the agents that I work with, because I still speak to people back there at ATF. And this is concerning. It's related, but it's concerning, and it should concern your listeners. Look, most of the people that I work with came on, like I did, from other law enforcement organizations, and they liked the idea of going after armed people who were hurting other people. It wasn't about the gun. It was about the conduct. And I mean, this was legions of the folks that I work with. And I'm not saying that we didn't make mistakes. We've discussed them in the past, Fast and Furious being one. There's Waco. There's Ruby Ridge. There are others. But the reality was agents came on for what I believe to be noble reasons. It wasn't about the gun. These folks are leaving. ATF, for the first time in my knowledge, has a retention problem where people are like, hey, I don't believe in this mission. And they're leaving for other agencies. My concern is who replaces those agents. And somebody listening will say, hopefully nobody, right? But the reality is, do we replace those agents with people who are anti-gun? That concerns me. The other thing is, this ruling is 330-something pages long. So I actually was discussing it last week. I was at the 9/11 Memorial and Museum with a retired ATF deputy director, and he and I both were somewhat appalled by it because, look, it's subject to interpretation. It's subject to overreach. Is it one step closer to a registry, which ATF does not have? But I know that they do document like multiple sales and traces are documented so that, you know, it's queryable. But purchases generally aren't. And is it one step closer to universal background checks? I mean, look, if I have several firearms of my own, if I decide that I don't like one of them, or if I came upon hard financial times and had to sell one here, sell one there, I'm not engaged in the business. You know what I mean? So, I mean, there's just so many things about this that really bother me. And it's just one more example of this current ATF director, who I heard is a nice man, who I've never met, full disclosure, who's being misguided by folks at the White House who have some very strong opinions against firearms, not even against criminal conduct, as we've seen what's going on in our country, but against the firearm. And it offends me. I don't know how else to describe it. It offends me.
Yeah, well, it is, because it is offensive. And, you know, I think you're right. I mean, I think obviously the White House has been pretty upfront about moving us closer to universal background checks. We've heard umpteen quotes about closing the gun show loophole, which, as you well know, Pete, doesn't exist, right? I mean, the same rules apply whether you're at a gun show, a brick and mortar location, you're selling firearms out of your home. If you are engaged in the business, you need an FFL. If you're not, if you're an occasional seller selling a firearm or two from your personal collection, up until now, you've not needed a federal firearms license because you're not engaged in the business. But as you say, you know, when Congress passed the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act, they tweaked the definition, right, to remove the word livelihood, basically. So this doesn't have to be your primary source of income in order to be engaged in the business. Okay, fine. But now you've got this rule where the ATF says, listen, you don't even actually have to complete a single sale in order for us to consider you engaged in the business, as long as you're offering a gun for sale. And maybe you're telling that buyer, hey, you know, I've got a couple more guns I'd be willing to part with. If you are deriving a profit, we don't know what that is, could be a penny, right? That's a sign that you're engaged in the business. So obviously, from a constitutional perspective, we've got our concerns, right, about the backdoor registration of gun owners, about where this is going. But, you know, one of the things I thought was really interesting, Pete, I was rereading the National Shooting Sports Foundation's public comment about this proposed rule, and they got into the history of how engaged in the business was defined. And you go back to the 1980s during the Firearms Owner Protection Act debate. And there was a lot of concern at the time that there were too many FFLs, that people were getting their license, even though they were not really engaged in the business, because it allowed them to buy firearms at wholesale, right, instead of paying retail prices. And so one of the concerns in the 80s was, okay, we need to make sure that the people who have these licenses really are engaged in the business. So let's tighten up that definition. Let's reduce the number of FFLs so that our agents can, you know, they're not looking for needles in the haystack, right? Maybe we're going to shrink the size of that haystack a little bit. Now it seems like they're taking the opposite approach. They ostensibly want hundreds of thousands of Americans to go and get their FFL so that they don't run afoul of the law. Failing that, I guess they want those sellers to put their buyers through a background check. Although what's interesting to me about this, Pete, is that that's not necessarily an off-ramp to legality, right? If the ATF says you're engaged in the business, Technically, it doesn't matter if you put if you went to a gun store and you put your buyer through a background check, you need that FFL, right?
Right. Yeah. No, it's hypocritical. And listen, I like I said, I've taken a strong stance on this because I truly believe in it. The firearms industry, you mentioned the gun show loophole. Yes, when we were in Phoenix, we had people who would show up at gun shows and they would hint that they were selling off paper. Do you know how we found out about those folks? From licensed gun dealers who would tell us. So I get really upset when I see what ATF is doing to the firearms industry. And NSSF has been a good partner with ATF over the years in the Don't Lie for the Other Guy campaign and providing gun locks for child safety. I mean, they've done things that I think were noble. And I know some of the things that folks get, you know, frustrated with whoever, whether it's GOA, NSSF, NRA over certain things. I mean, these are hot button issues when you're talking about firearms. But the industry was always, in my opinion, a good partner in public safety. What this does, I don't know if this affects public safety at all. It just makes for folks that want to engage in owning firearms, perhaps selling a firearm to a neighbor, puts them in a very, very difficult position, one I don't agree with. But I mean, the firearms industry was always a friend. The other thing that offends me, somewhat related, is the whole name and shame thing that recently happened, where ATF decided that they were going to name some of the deals. I mean, really, Cabela's? I mean, for the love of God. These are folks, a straw purchase, for example, is an act of deception. It is a crime. Like, so when dealers identified a straw purchase that was suspicious, they would call us. But if someone's really good at deception and can get away with purchasing that firearm and they go out and sell it to somebody else again, illegally, which is chargeable, that's not on the dealer. It shouldn't be on the dealer. So everything that they're doing seems to be attacking the gun industry, legitimate gun owners, and distracting them from the mission that I believed in, which was to go after the people who were using guns to rob others, to hurt others, to do home invasions. You know, and again, going back to what I said earlier, the fact that people are leaving is concerning to me because who, again, replaces? I mean, you hear all of these things about the weaponization of government. And at first I was like, come on. Now I'm starting to believe it. The other thing is the ATF director, Dettelbach, has brought in, from what I'm told by a number of people, attorneys from outside to come in and staff, like they sit in his executive conference room. They make a lot of these decisions. Well, when the next administration comes in and Dettelbach leaves, because, if Trump wins, for example, he'll bring in his own, or I'm sure Kennedy would bring in somebody else, whoever. These attorneys, what happens to them? Are they now there? I mean, have they become kind of like a deep state that'll still be left behind to kind of sway which direction ATF goes in? It's troublesome, and I think it might have some long-term effects. And look, I hope whoever comes in fixes this, but what's the next step for these folks? You know what I mean? It's like they're clawing away at our rights, right? Not our privileges, but our rights. They're clawing away at them. Where does it end?
I know where they want it to end, right? And, you know, and going back to the name and shame stuff with the demand to list that was publicized, I don't know if you saw this, but did you see that the Metropolitan Police Department, Washington, D.C. Police Department, is on the demand to list?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which to me, that shows just, you know, the absurdity of releasing this list. Right. And I know that the ATF spokesperson said, look, being on this list isn't evidence that you've done anything wrong. But the media has certainly reported it that way. Right. These are the stores that are selling the most crime guns. I mean, that's the headline that we've seen. And here you have Washington, D.C.'s police department, because for a time they were basically the only FFL in business in D.C. because there are no gun stores. Right. So they transferred at least 25 guns that were traced within a 2-year period. Right. Does that mean that the Metropolitan Police Department is a bad apple gun dealer? No.
But right. Kim, what that spokesperson said. Then why release the list?
Yeah,
it was to shame folks. Look, I can tell you that. In my a little over 20 years with ATF, no previous ATF director would have even thought of doing that. So, I mean, what's going on there is concerning. I really wish that Dettelbach would focus on crime and perhaps going out to some of these U.S. attorney's offices who aren't necessarily toeing the line. For example, Chicago, Baltimore, the District of Columbia, where they pass on a lot of cases involving violent crime because they're too busy doing God knows what. Maybe he should have sit down with those folks and try to get them, you know, motivated to actually getting some violent people off the street. Instead, they're wasting their time demonizing an industry and inanimate objects. Go figure.
So what do you think is going to be the real impact of this new rule, Pete? If it goes into effect, I know that There are attempts in Congress to repeal this rule via the Congressional Review Act. I'm sure there's going to be litigation once the rule goes into effect. But let's say that a judge does allow this to be enforced. What's going to be the impact, first of all, on gun owners? And what's going to be the impact within the agency, you think?
Well, within the agency, it's already having an impact. Like I said, folks don't believe in the mission, so the good folks are leaving. The people that you want working at ATF are looking for jobs, many of them. Some of them will stay and wait out their retirement. As far as like where this overreach will lead, that's anybody's guess. It's concerning. Look, when I was in Phoenix, the group that worked alongside of us, I was in Phoenix Group 1. Phoenix Group 2 made a couple of cases where they went after middle-aged men who were selling guns. They were buying them and selling them at gun shows. They were doing, they were engaged in a business without the license, right? We didn't work those cases because with the limited resources we had, we wanted to go after people who were actually influencing violence to happen, right? Not some guy who is trying to make, an extra $100 a month to supplement his pension, selling guns to other guys who were going out at Target shooting. They weren't selling them to criminals, right? So they would come on the radar though. So we prioritized going after, as Director Jones used to call them, the trigger pullers, like not trigger pulling at a target range, obviously, or hunting, but out in urban areas, shooting other kids, drive-by shootings and whatnot. So, it just bothers me, like where are they going to focus their resources, their limited resources? And, I don't understand why they would even dream of going down this path, frankly, but it's troublesome where it could lead.
Well, I know the last time we talked, you brought up Rob Wilcox, right? The former Everytown lobbyist who's now at the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention. And I think the gun controls lobby's fingerprints are all over this new rule,
yeah.
Right? You say, what's the ATF going to do? I think my suspicion is that the ATF is going to do whatever the gun control lobby wants them to do. And if that means that they're going after, marginal cases as opposed to going after, guys that are running guns to the cartels, then that's what's going to happen. Because the goal here, I think, is to intimidate gun owners into compliance, right? Either getting that FFL, not selling that firearm from your personal collection, maybe trying to indemnify yourself by putting that sale through a background check at a gun store. But that's where I see this going, because you've got the anti-gunners who are not just influencing policy, but they're making the policy at ATF right now.
I would agree. They're driving policy. And look, again, I spent 20 years with ATF. I left before Dettelbach came in. I left partially because of a speech that Merrick Garland gave at ATF headquarters that was clearly soft on crime, hard on guns. So, it seems to be where this administration is going. There's no doubt that they are driving policy. And the White House's influence on ATF now is unlike anything I saw in my time. Like, look, ATF, the previous directors at least, always took this position of we need to be apolitical. We couldn't get dragged into any corner because the laws that we enforced were controversial in of themselves, right? Because of the passion behind them. So how this director is allowing the White House to have so much influence on the organization is really, in my opinion, just poor leadership, frankly. He's allowing the entire organization to be portrayed as being very political. And this is dangerous for the field agents too, because there's a lot of emotion, right, going on right now with all of these political stances, which, in my opinion, endangers an agent that's knocking on the door to go pick up something that is not legislated by Congress, that is written in some sort of a ruling because they wanted to ban the pistol brace. You name the ruling, when it's not something that's written in law by Congress, that's something some director decides is a path we need to go down. That is not a position that I want my agents, when I was a supervisor, be it a first line supervisor or a special agent in charge of a field division, I wouldn't want my people going out enforcing those things, because it's just not, it's not the law.
Yeah, well, it is not the law, but the ATF says it's a rule, and DOJ is going to defend that rule, and we'll see where this engaged in the business rule goes. Last question for you, Pete. I'm just curious. We talked about, again, the overly broad definition, the new definition of engaged in the business. Even the old definition did not have a clear, bright line, right? There were more guide rails. If you were, again, repeatedly devoting time and attention, buying and reselling firearms, all of which, by the way, is still in the statute. ATF's just now ignoring this. Right. But if you were writing this statute, if you were Congress, not the ATF, but if you were writing this statute, Are there any tweaks that you would make so that there is a clear, bright line, or there would be a clear, bright line so that folks would know, okay, if I cross over here, I need to get an FFL. If I stay on this side of the line, I'm okay.
Well, we had an unwritten rule when I worked in New York and in Phoenix. There were no rules because the U.S. Attorney's Office there just didn't care. You could have sold 100 guns and, you know, illegally to cartel members and, well, we'll indict it later. But in New York, there was kind of an unwritten rule that you had to do 3 undercover deals in order to charge somebody for being engaged in the business. So you had to do multiple deals. There was conversation that came along with it. I honestly don't know that once they had defined a firearms trafficking statute, if they even needed the engaged in the business rule. I never liked that statute because it was open to interpretation even back then. That's just my opinion.
Okay. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt, but you're saying now that there's the gun trafficking statute that was put in place as part of the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act.
Yeah, I'd say that should have replaced engaged in the business because engaged in the business was already too open to interpretation. Mm-hmm. Look, if you're selling guns to gangbangers, to cartels, to bank robbers, knowing that they're going to go out there and commit crimes, or you're being shady yourself, then you should be held accountable. I've always held myself accountable for my actions. People need to be held accountable for bad acts. But, you know, again, if some elderly man buys a gun and now all of a sudden he's down on his luck and he needs to sell it, and he had a collection of 100 guns that were his and he's selling one here, one there to make ends meet. Is that engaged in the business? No, he didn't perhaps buy those guns with the intent on selling them, right? He had a collection. And it's funny because I remember one time in Phoenix, there was this person that hit a storage locker, and this individual had over 1,000 firearms in the storage locker. And this person was a little bit of a nut job. And he had threatened to kill his boss at Honeywell. And the condition, these were some really nice firearms, but the condition he kept them in was somewhat appalling. But a reporter asked me, do you have a problem with him having this many guns? And I'm like, if he wasn't committing crimes, no. And this reporter was like taken aback. Like, you're an ATF agent. You don't have a problem with a person owning 100 guns? Look, the reality is if you want 100, you want to own 1,000, that's your business as long as you're not endangering kids by leaving them loaded around your house. I mean, there's certain things that I think that we have an obligation to do as gun owners, that, you know, keep ourselves safe, keep people safe, not leave them out in the front yard where someone could walk off with them. But if you want to own 100, you want to own 1,000 firearms, you should be able to do that. But at some point, if like you decide, hey, you know, for example, my eyesight's going, so I got to shoot with readers on. If I decide like, hey, you know, I don't enjoy shooting as much as I did 5 years ago, and I want to sell 5 or 6 of my firearms, am I now engaged in the business? And if I want to sell them to a neighbor or a coworker who I know is not a criminal, who I've known for decades, you know, why should I be prohibited from doing that? It's just, to me, it's foolishness. It's unnecessary. They have the laws at their fingertips. They've had them. There's no need to go down this path.
Well, I got to say, Pete, if we do get a chance to replace Biden in November, I'm nominating you to be the next ATF director. Would you do it?
You know, Cam, somebody asked me, when I published a book, there were people who thought I was angling for that. I will quote a friend. Why would I call the Coast Guard and ask them to send a helicopter to take me and deposit me on the bridge of the Titanic after it hit the iceberg? You know, I never say never, but I'm not looking to go down that path, you know, and I have friends in the industry who I've made friends, you know, because of my stances that I've taken since then that might complicate that, you know? So, I mean, I'd like to see ATF get fixed. I would love to help advise somebody to do that. But yeah, I don't think I would ever be, besides I'm a pretty opinionated guy. I don't know that any attorney general would ever pick me to be an ATF director, to be honest with you.
Well, I'm still going to lobby for it. Hey, listen, well, Pete, I go ahead.
This is an important election and I'm not the most political guy, but what I'm seeing coming out of this White House is it, like I said before, it offends me. So, anybody but Joe in 24 is what I've been telling people.
Listen, Pete, as always, man, I really appreciate you coming on the program. Let folks know how they can pick up a copy of your new book.
Sure. It's available at Amazon. But if they want a signed copy, it's The Deadly Path. It's behind me there. It's on Amazon, or you can get it at my website. It's www.peterjforcelli.com.
And I tell the audience once again, this is a gripping book. When I sat down to read, I read the first couple of chapters, then I had to get back to work, and then I polished off the rest of the book in a single day. I could not put it down. So it has my endorsement. If you want to know more about Operation Fast and Furious, pick up Pete's book. It is a must read. And Peter, thank you as always for coming on the program, sir. Look forward to getting a chance to do this again very soon.
So do I. And hey, happy anniversary.
Hey, thanks, Pete. Talk to you soon, man.
Take care, Cap.
Once again, thanks to Pete for joining me on the program. And yeah, looking forward to talking more with him in the future. Right now, before we get to our good deed of the day, our recidivist report, and our armed citizen story, let's talk about this for a second. The very heart of our democracy lies a principle that we hold sacred, free speech. It's the cornerstone that supports every freedom we cherish. Yet in today's digital age, discussions about our wealth, our rights, and our future are being silenced or overshadowed by mainstream narratives, leaving many feeling voiceless in conversations that are crucial to our financial independence and security. That's where Wealth Protection Research steps in, armed with a mission that's never been more critical. Wealth Protection Research is not a financial advisory firm. They are defenders of free speech, committed to giving a voice to the silenced. Wealth Protection Research tirelessly seeks out financial experts. These are the voices that challenge prevailing narratives, especially as we navigate the uncertainties of the 2024 election. Wealth Protection Research has created a 2024 Election Wealth Protection Report. Now, this free report highlights the three best ideas for protecting and growing your money heading into the 2024 election. It contains ideas the mainstream media won't touch, and listeners can get it completely free. Text IDEAS to 76626 to claim your free copy. If you believe in the sanctity of free speech and the importance of financial freedom, then act now. Text IDEAS to 76626 to claim your free copy of this 2024 Election Protection Report. It's time to widen the scope of what we're told, to hear the ideas the establishment doesn't think you can handle, and to take control of our financial destinies. Text IDEAS to 76626 to claim your free copy. All right, let's turn our attention now to today's armed citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We will start there with a case out of Toledo, Ohio, where a man sentenced to probation for hitting a victim with a shovel and then leading police on a chase. Now, that was actually a separate incident where he led police on the chase. According to court records, 37-year-old Justin Poor pleaded guilty to felonious assault, as well as failure to comply on April the 1st. He appeared back in court on April 15th, where Judge Dean Mandrow sentenced him to 5 years of probation and his driver's license also suspended for 3 years. Poor allegedly hit a man with a shovel back on November the 9th. Now, he was arrested the following month, December 14th, but only after police say he led officers on a high-speed chase through a residential neighborhood. No lights on his vehicle. It was nighttime. Very dangerous situation. Following the pursuit, Poor then exited his vehicle, ran from the police before officers caught him. And again, offered a plea deal, hit somebody in the head with a shovel, right? Endangered pedestrians, endangered motorists. And still, prosecutors say, you know what? Nah, prison's not for you, good sir. Just keep your nose clean and we'll send you on your merry way. I have issues with this. Ohio is a great state for our Second Amendment rights, but still could use some work when it comes to public safety. Today's armed citizen story from Henderson, Nevada, where police say a homeowner woke up to somebody in his home who was not supposed to be there and then fired shots at that unknown suspect. This was Saturday evening in the Las Vegas suburb. Police say that officers responded to a home in the Anthem Country Club area about 9:30 Saturday night in a reference to a burglary in progress. Authorities say the occupant of the home, already asleep, by the way, 9:30 on Saturday, but woke up to a, quote, unknown suspect inside the home. Authorities say the homeowner then shot at the suspect, causing the suspect to flee the scene. No report of any injuries to that suspect, but no report of any identities for that suspect either. But thankfully, the occupant of the home was uninjured in their encounter with the stranger there on Saturday night. Finally, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing, a man from Schuylkill, I believe this was Schuylkill, Pennsylvania, Minersville, Pennsylvania, Schuylkill County, who was able to save one of his neighbors when their home caught fire over the weekend. This was pretty incredible. The gentleman in question, Oscar Rivera, he said he could actually hear when the fire started. He says, I was in the backyard with my kids playing. All of a sudden, you hear a boom. And so he runs out from the backyard to the front yard of his home, and he sees his neighbor's home on fire across the street. He also realized that there was somebody on the roof. He said, I looked at the guys on the roof, like the window sticking out, saying, help me, help me. Fire department was already on the way, but Rivera said he was concerned that they weren't going to get there in time. So he said, my neighbor came, he got the ladder, we put it right there, and then that's when the adrenaline came, and I just started jumping, kind of parkoured his way up the ladder, up the roof, and made his way to the top floor. I think it was a three-story home. And he said, the moment I wasn't scared. I just wanted to save him. That's what I wanted to do. So he got there. And again, there's an individual who's sort of half hanging out of the window. Rivera's wife yelling, oh, my God, get him. Grab his pants. He said, the smoke blew, so I had to move out of the way. And then that's when I grabbed him. He was burned, and I just pulled him out. At that point, fire crews had arrived. They were able to climb up the ladder to help Rivera and the occupant of the home down. Rivera says the man suffered critical burns, and he's not sure of the extent of the injuries at this time. He says, I hope he's okay. I'm praying for him. In all, there were six homes that were damaged, 20 people evacuated overall. The Minersville Police and Fire Department still haven't determined what exactly caused that fire, but there were no fatalities. And that is, it sounds like, in large part because of the courageous and heroic actions of Oscar Rivera, who was there for his neighbor when his neighbor was in need. So Oscar Rivera, in the right place, at the right time, willing, able to do the right thing. We thank you for your very, very good deed. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. I will be back with you tomorrow when we will be celebrating, I guess, the 20th anniversary in one day. Actually, we'll be celebrating the first appearance of investigative reporter Lee Williams on Bearing Arms, Cam and Company, at least the first appearance in a while. But Lee's been doing some great work investigating the ATF raid on Brian Malinowski, the Little Rock Airport executive who was under investigation for selling firearms without a federal firearms license when agents conducted a raid on his home in the pre-dawn hours last month. Malinowski was shot and killed. His family and the family's attorney say that they've seen no evidence that the ATF actually announced themselves before they broke down the front door. And they believe that Malinowski may have armed himself thinking that there were intruders breaking into the home. And that's why he was shot and killed, maybe firing at an officer that he thought was, again, a burglar or a home invader. So Lee's been doing great work covering this case. We're going to talk about it on Wednesday's Cam and Company. I would encourage you to check that out tomorrow. But I also encourage you to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day, where we are keeping you apprised on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from across the nation. And if you like what you see, I'd also encourage you to become a VIP or VIP Gold member. In fact, if you want to give me an anniversary present, you can give yourself a present, too. If you use the promo code SAVEAMERICA when you go to BearingArms.com/subscribe, you can get a significant savings on your VIP or VIP membership. And not only will you get exclusive content unavailable to non-subscribers, but you'll get that warm, fuzzy feeling of knowing that you are continuing to support the independent pro-Second Amendment journalism that we do here on Bearing Arms Cam and Company and at BearingArms.com. We certainly do appreciate your support. I wouldn't be here if it weren't for your support. So thank you again, and I'm looking forward to seeing you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.